I want to take you through to the end of the 4th century in the next half of tonight and consolidate the Nicene Creed as it emerges. Well, let's then continue through to the end of the century. The Council of Nicaea took place in 325. Constantine himself died in 337, that's 12 years afterwards, and his son, Constantius, he had two sons, Constantine II and Constantius, they actually set up a place that was Byzantium, you know, just across on the European side of the straits here from the Black Sea to the Aegean, and on the other side there they changed the name of Byzantium to Constantinople, obviously after their dad, and took the imperial throne, if you like, to there, and took with them Bishop Eusebius of Nicomedia, now became the first patriarch, or bishop, of Constantinople, this new emerging imperial see. Well, the second council of the church, so-called for reasons that I'll mention later, was 381. So that's whatever, 56 years later. The period between the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Constantinople, that whatever I gave you a minute ago, how many years, my additions have forgotten, 56 or something, was a period of unbelievable confusion of thought and politics. My poor little brain, I assure you, is racked over it hundreds of times, and if what I'm going to say to you now appears clear, it's only because I've been very selective in my attempt to achieve clarity. I hope I've got the line right, and what I'm saying is as intelligent as I can put it together, but be aware of the incredible complexity. To describe the confusion first, in as confusing a way as I can. It was a period of great instability in the Christian community. And perhaps if I start here, you can see one of the major reasons for instability. Being a member of the Christian church becomes a very different thing. Up till then, it was a very great risk. You wouldn't become a member of the Christian community unless it really meant something to you. Because the possibility of martyrdom, for a start, was lurking around the corner. You wouldn't be very popular in general. You wouldn't get a job. It wouldn't favour you in society. I know I'm simplifying it, but that's generally true. And right up till these early 300s, people were being murdered just for being Christian. So you can picture a bit of that scene. After the conversion, so-called, of Constantine, then here's a whole new area for power, prestige, position in society. I mean, if you want to get on, if you want to be the emperor's whatever, well, I mean, being a Christian's the in thing to be. So there's a big adult, and there's a whole world there to change. How's the church going to handle that? That's a big, big, big change, really it is, as you can probably imagine. It's there are two ways of looking at this situation, and at this time you get one movement, is the movement, don't have anything to do with the world. The world is wicked. The world is, the Roman thing is all corrupting. Christianity is essentially very ascetical, very withdrawn from the world and so on, and if they're not going to persecute you, well, persecute yourself for God's sake, you know. So Simon Stylites keeps emerging in the literature this time, who spent so many years up on top of a pole in northern Syria somewhere, you know, away from the world. This is the period of the monks in the desert, and I'm not going to knock the monks in the desert or whatever, but withdrawal from the world is a very favourite occupation among those who want to be perfect. That's one movement. The other movement is, let's get in. Get into it. This is great. Opportunities emerging everywhere. Become a bishop, for God's sake. And so you get lost in the world. In the middle, I suppose if I can put it in those simple terms, you've got people recognising the mission of the church, great people, and we saw right back to Clement Justin, they've always been there, recognising the revelation of God that's in the world already, recognising the beauty of the Roman and Greek poets, and somehow on the interface between the church now and the world is an exciting opportunity for mutual growth and whatever. And that's where the church is going to live her life, because we're made of real people. But in the middle of all that, what do you do now with people who are coming in who really don't have faith and yet come to Mass, if I can put it in those terms? How do you handle that? The key question, in a way, is the church a church of saints, which probably would have been a subconscious expectation up till this point? Or is it a church of sinners being sanctified? Who's in the church? That was real practical. That meant to things like, what happens to the people in the persecution under Diocletian, just over? What about now they want to come back? They said they weren't Christians. They avoided martyrdom back in the year 310. Now, when martyrs went to the stake, these lot ducked out for cover. Don't blame them. We're probably among them. So but now it becomes convenient to come back. So they say, oh, well, we really would like to be Christians. Do you allow them back into the church? The church generally said, of course. Some people said, well, you know, my father was martyred. I'm not going to have this bloke coming in when he, you know, can't you see it all happening? And I think there's that problem in the church. And that actually ripped the Western church, which we're not looking at, during this period, in the middle of the 300s to the middle of the 400s, the Western church was ripped apart over this issue. Firstly, the Novatian schism, and then the Donatist schism. North African church broke down the middle over it. There are two bishops in every diocese in the north of Africa at this time. Those who wouldn't, who stuck by there and wouldn't allow any of these other bishops to come back, who'd handed over the sacred books, you know, when they should have gone to martyrdom, so others claim. And the other group, the general, have-a-go, ordinary Christian person who is saying, no, you know, you've got to receive people back. Have I confused you there, or have you got a bit of a fear for it? Anyway, that did happen, and really the North African church was in a total mess and destroyed itself, sadly. Augustine was right in the middle of all that, you might know. That was a problem in the East, but not so much, because Arianism had everybody concerned. The intellectual pursuit of the truth was there, and while the bishops were going one way and the other, and this confusion reigned, another area of confusion was the emperor using his power for his own advantage. Constantius, the son of Constantine, was an Arian, and pushed it. By the time he died in a date that escapes me, and I can't think, yes, I've got it there, have I? 361. By the time Constantius died in 361, you could say every bishop in the Eastern Church was an Arian. Every bishop was a heretic, put it in our terms. All the Orthodox bishops were in Siberia, been banished from because of what their position is, because he was a strong believer in the Arian position. It was easier to understand. It was a good accommodation with paganism. It was a better way of getting unity because it didn't demand as much of the mind and whatever else. A whole lot of reasons, but that is true at any rate. I've already spoken about the ambiguity of language. What do we believe? What do you do with this Nicene Creed? The biggest problem, mentioning it quickly again, is that it had been already denounced as a statement when Paul of Samosata had been condemned in, 362 for holding it, because it was Sabellian. It was claiming that the Father and the Son were really just one. And so groups came up everywhere, and they kept saying things like, not homoousios, but homoios, which means like. The Son is like the Father. And that was a great movement. Another group said, no, homoiousios, not homoousios, which is the same being. Homoi means like being. He was of like being with the Father. Let's be content with that, said some bishops, including Eusebius of Caesarea. You know, there's been an argument about words. He said, look, you know, okay, he's divine, and let's stick with that. And they hated the bloke we're going to talk about in a moment, who was stubbornly sticking to the Council of Nicaea down in Alexandria. All right, so all that confusion with hypocrisy on some parts. Eusebius of Constantinople seems to have been a quite irreligious man who was simply interested in the pomp of court and whatever debate came out as long as he was in power, seems to have been that. And the fanaticism on the one hand, I've tried to give you that first generation and a half in the new Constantine world had a lot to cope with. If you can make the transference, I think it's not unlike the Vatican II Church of which we are part. A whole new mental horizon has opened up to a church that for a long time, I won't say was persecuted, but you know, when my father tried to get a job, he couldn't get a lot of jobs because he was a Catholic. Eh? Similarly, my mother, that's not that long ago, couldn't get many jobs in Australia because she was Catholic. Advertisements would come out, Catholics need not apply, in the newspaper. That's going back in the 1920s. So you've got that kind of history of the Catholic Church defending against, I'm speaking of Catholic-Protestant problem now, you know, in Northern Ireland, whatever. Now the Vatican II Catholic Church opens up with a whole sense of mission to the world. And that's a big leap, brave new world thing. We've got the same. I think we can identify with the confusion of this early church at this period, with incredible opportunities opening up, with incredible dangers too, and understandably most are going to back off or get lost. How do we hold the truth at this journey? Well, that hasn't confused you too much. The Arians I've already mentioned, led by this Eusebius, who actually converted Constantine on his deathbed, or baptized him on his deathbed, and had a big influence over his family, including Constantius. He was the leader of the Arians, and that the opposite pole was held by a man called Athanasius, of great renown. I'm sure everyone here would have heard of him. Athanasius, who was a deacon at the Council of Nicaea and went there as a theological advisor as a young man to Bishop Alexander, and was present at the whole thing. And he becomes the most staunch upholder of Nicaea. He was Bishop of Alexandria for a long time, 328 to 373, practically right through the period we're talking about. And again, what's that, 45 years. Interestingly, 17 of those years were spent in exile. Five different times he was exiled. One time he was exiled over into the west, which meant he had considerable influence over there. The other time they tried to get him and he hid. The people hid him actually in Alexandria. Some quite interesting stories about how he escaped across the top of his... That's all the history there. How he got out through the shower window and was seen running in his nightshirt across the rooftops of Alexandria and was hidden by people and moved from house to house and spent about 5 years doing all his writing underground. In the very city where and the soldiers never ever quite got hold of him. It takes us back to the persecution period in Ireland. But anyhow, this definitely determined, very brave, and I'd say brilliant man, Athanasius, was the great upholder. And most of the bishops, as far as I can see, had little liking for him because they were trying to get the church together. They were trying to follow the emperor. They were trying to follow the providence of God and get on with converting the world. And here you've got this bloke saying, no, we're going to stick to, you know, kind of trying to stamp him out half the time, so whatever. In 362, the year the death of Constantius, when the emperor died, well, he came back, snuck back in, to a great cheering multitude. They all loved him in his own land. He returned after 6 years and held a council of Alexandria, which has some importance, hard to estimate, but in this breakthrough between all the confusion of terminology. And this seems to have been the position that he upheld. What he decided to do was almost arbitrarily define words, and I guess that's what you've got to do after a while. It's the insight that matters. It's what you've seen, and you've got to find a word for it. So he started to define words, and people started to form around those definitions, like ousia. He kind of said, well, look, let's use ousia for that which is identical in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And let's use hypostasis for that which is distinct. I mean, he could have gone the other way if he wanted to. I mean, he's just fairly arbitrary, not entirely, use of words. Ousia will be the being of God. There's only one being in God. So let's say that the Father, Son, and Spirit have the same being, homoousios. Once you get into homoousios, or homoios, he says, you're in terrible danger, which you are, of reducing or limiting Jesus' divinity, or making it something by participation in God rather than the actual being of God. So he wouldn't have any of that, and therefore stuck with homoousios. But he said, and you can see the break here from Nicaea, let's not use hypostasis and ousia interchangeably. Let's use hypostasis, substance, understanding, as the word for that we do understand, not comprehensively, but our mind understands that the underlying reality that the Father, while God, and the Son, while the one God, are not identical. There's no way of grasping all of that. But that is our statement. That's what we assert as Christians. Let's use this word for that. However, in that very same council, he said, but let's not fight over words. If, he said, if bishops, anybody, wants to say, no, there's only one hypostasis in God. There's only one being, ousia, and ousia and hypostasis mean the same to us. So there's only one hypostasis. Simply ask them the question, fine. If that's how you're going to use your words, that's fine. But if you do, do you believe that the Father and Son and Spirit are distinct? If they said yes, he said, fine, that's orthodox. The other group that said, no, there are three hypostases in God, which was his own favourite position. If people say there are three, then Athanasius asked them, well, do you believe there are one God or three gods? If they said one God, then fine. Do you see the kind of compromise, you might say? More than that, I think a recognition that the fight is not over words, but over a mystery and a worship religious experience which we've got to be able to somehow say in ways where we agree by defining our terms what we mean by them. Well, that was the position he took up in that Council of Alexandria, and it seems, I say seems, I find it very hard to be absolutely sure of this, it seems to have won the day. It enabled the different groups who did believe that there was only one God, and yet did believe that the Father, Son and Spirit were somehow, they'd never understand how, distinct. It enabled them to come together and isolate the very few who were determined, in effect, to deny the divinity of Jesus, to deny that he was actually the one God. That's in 362. Okay. A few words from Athanasius, just to give you a taste of his language. Allow me to do this fairly quickly. If you just listen, as it were, it might give you an impression. This is from his book called the Synods, his history of the Synods that he's talking about, and then his writings against Arius. It is not as if God, needing somebody to help him, assumed a son from outside himself. Neither are the things that God made equal to him in dignity, so that they ought to be honoured as he is honoured, or that we should say that they and the Father are one. Besides, who will say that the sun and its brightness are two different lights or different substances? Hypostases. The divinity of the Father is in the Son, so that whoever sees the Son sees the Father in him. I don't want to claim that that's clear. I don't think it is. But it does indicate this man's faith. Perhaps other statements might. Because they are one, I think this is the clearest statement Athanasius made, because they are one, and because the divinity itself is also one, what is said of the Father is said also of the Son, except the name Father. That was the clearest statement to this point of time made anywhere, to my knowledge, trying to put out in words the mystery of our faith. That whatever you say of the Father, you must say of the Son. Whatever. Father created the world, the Son created the world. everything that's, because there is only one God, they are the one being. The only thing that distinguishes Father from Son is the fact that the Father is the Father of the Son. It's their relationship, Father to Son, and of course we'll let it include Spirit, you know, but just it's the relationship between them that identifies them as distinct. Only the relationship, the actual being they have, is absolutely the one being, and what they do is absolutely the same. One more statement of Athanasius. When we speak of him as offspring, we do not understand this in a human way. And when we acknowledge God as Father, we do not attribute bodily characteristics to him. In the same way, when we hear him described as of one being, homoousios, we must transcend the senses utterly. And following the proverb, the book of Proverbs, chapter 23, verse 1 is the reference, we must understand spiritually what is laid before us. To know that as life comes from the source and brightness from the light, so he is truly Son out of the Father and like the Father.